You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, and welcome to my first show. Today's guest is someone I've admired and watched on screen, watched on stage, watched in my dreams to maybe be my friend one day because she's really cool. And that's Uzo Aduba. It's so nice to meet you.
You as well. Wait, what do I say after that?
you know, it's the kind of thing where like you just, maybe you feel this way too, but when you watch people on television and you get to know them and then you watch them in interviews, you sort of think like, oh, we'd be friends. We would totally be
friends. Yes. I say that about Beyonce.
I have felt that way about Barack Obama my entire life. I was like, yeah. We would be friends. We have the same humor. But I feel that way about you. So I'm really excited to talk with you today.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask you a question that we ask everyone in these times, which is, how are you doing?
I am doing is what I answer in these times, because I think that's that's as much as all we can do. You know, I am. Some days it's a wave. You know, some days I can stand on the surfboard, do every trick, catch every wave. Sometimes I'll get knocked down every time, depending on what's happening out in the world at any given moment. But I'm doing, you know, I am fortunate and I have been able to sit down and be at home because I take this very seriously. For you know, both myself and for my neighbors. And I think I had a time where it was like, you know, lockdown, like, okay, we're all in the beginning, you know, like this is so new. And then it's like, we're still locked down, you know. And then now have sort of adjusted and found a rhythm to life in this new normal. That has brought some a joy back into it.
Good. I think it is pretty vital that we find that joy however we can.
Right.
Otherwise, oof.
Heavy.
Oof. And you're in LA? In New York?
I'm in New
Boston?
York.
New York, okay.
I've been doing quarantine in New York.
Excellent. I know that New York has found its light in a way amidst the rest of the country. And that's something to be really proud of.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's like reflective also of like the feeling of a lot of New Yorkers, what I was saying for myself, you know, it started off so intensely here because at one point, you know, in the very beginning, we were the epicenter and, you know, we had a very real experience with it as far as, you know, the first thing I remember about it was the constant drone of ambulances all the time. And the lines out of the hospital and, you know, the refrigerator trucks, all of these things were very real for us. And as our numbers have come down, as we New Yorkers often do, we've come together and united towards a common purpose, a common goal. We've watched those things slowly and surely reduce. Watch our numbers reduce, watch the everyday traumas reduce. We live in a city where we just have to take care of each other. You know, I didn't realize how neighborly New York was until we were in this pandemic.
For some reason, this morning in the shower, where I have all my brilliant thoughts, I actually thought about what is a positivity from all this. And that was something that struck me as well, was our care for each other. Mm-hmm. That is abundant and clear now in a way where I don't know if it always was.
Yeah, I never thought of New York City as a small town. And yet it has a lot of small town sensibilities, at least in this moment, you know, of really looking after each other and doing what we got to do and taking care of each other in a way that's just, you know, as early as this morning, you know, I just was out walking my dog and stood in this line for this little bitty coffee shop that is open, you know, just through the front of their door. And the guy who was standing at the counter didn't have any change on him, enough change for a dog treat. And the owner just gave one out. You know what I mean? It's just, I just gave one to him anyway. And I just thought, you know, I grew up in a small town and that's something that would happen in my hometown. But here we are in New York displaying our very best of ourselves.
I love that. I really do. I love a lot of things you've been doing lately, I must say. And you know, I hope you're finding the joy of your success in all this. I know probably as a very deep human, you recognize the pain, but you know, you had this groundbreaking performance of Shirley Chisholm in what I think was a monumental series of Mrs. America. And I have to believe that performance is taking on some renewed meaning now that Kamala Harris will be the first Black woman on a presidential ticket. I just, for someone who studied and lived within Shirley for so long, what does it feel like?
It feels incredible. It feels like a dream answered. She famously had said she wanted to create space for not just herself, but for all women. Yeah. And that she wanted to carve out seats at the table. And I think, you know, like there's that hashtag because of you, mm-hmm. you know, and because of her, there gets to be a Kamala Harris. There gets to be all of the women. There gets to be an Elizabeth Warren. There gets to be, you know, all of these women in this penultimate top note moment. Kamala gets to have that moment and answer a dream of Congresswoman Chisholm's in such a bright and loud and spacious way that I think is important. And she has now answered the call that Shirley Chisholm was given, you know, some 50 plus years ago. She is now going to be to this next generation of women and women who stand beside her as well.
Yeah.
To have and hold space. So it's really exciting to see it, you know, especially we're telling this story at a time where she, you know, Shirley Chisholm was a trailblazer. She was the first one to do it.
Yeah.
And what that feels like to be the first, it's not a light thing that you carry when you do it. To be the first of anything is not easy. And it's just really wonderful to see what that effort and what that flag planting has now produced and will continue to produce.
What was it like to research and prepare for the role? What did you learn about yourself in the process?
Oh my gosh. To prepare for the role, I was like, I didn't realize how, I knew a bit about Shirley Chisholm. I knew that she was, I knew everything about her as far as being the first, but I didn't know much about her policies, which was exciting to see how much of her policy positions were major points throughout this 2020 primary, especially for most candidates. And then I also didn't know how much her campaign leaned into the conversation of hope and possibility. Mm. And she spoke all the time about possibility. What was possible for people if they thought beyond limitations. And I think that resonated so strongly for her, because you have to remember, you know, this is a woman who's running at a time where she's standing in the shadow of the Civil Rights Voting Act, the assassination of Martin Luther King, segregation, Jim Crow, you know, all of these things, and is elected as the first Black woman to Congress in 1968, is running for president in 1972, right?
Yeah.
And she is talking about these things about possibility. And so it's clear that the definition she held for herself was wholly different than the definitions people had for her. And I think that was what I was reminded of for myself, because I know what that feels like, to have people have a definition mm-hmm. of what is possible for you and what you know is possible for yourself. Mm. And to not subscribe to that limited view. And I think being in her space, wearing her shoes, it just reminded me to hold firm to my ideas and beliefs.
That's really beautiful to hear and quite inspiring. And I think actually maybe this is a great segue to the first question that we love to ask our guests, which is, what was the first show you saw? And perhaps,
TV show?
What did it mean to you? Theater show. What was
theater show?
The first theater show you ever saw, and what did it mean to you?
The first theater show I want to say almost two, because it's like the first theater show I ever saw was in second grade, was Mr. Popper's Penguins.
Oh.
At the Wheelock Primary Theater. That was the first show I ever saw that I can remember seeing, but I don't really remember much about it, because what I remember is we had read the book in class mm-hmm. and now we were seeing the show. And I just remember a lot of penguins. people dressed as penguins. That's the second grade.
Which is both horrifying and funny.
Yes. But then the show that had the biggest impact on me that I really remember was my school. Again, we went to go see A Christmas Carol at the North Shore Playhouse, North Shore Theater, Music Theater. Mm-hmm. And what I remember was all the kids kept talking a lot, and I would, and you know, you don't want to like stand out, but so you want to like a little bit fit in. You're like, haha, it's so weird. But I also was like, shh, I want to like hear what's going on, because I'm actually really fascinated with what's going on. And I remember there was all this pyro when Jacob Marley came out. And I remember the guy who was playing Jacob Marley, he either had green light on him coming from, the lights were coming from the ground. There was a lot of pyro, a lot of like steam, fog, dry ice, you know? And he was leaning back a lot, and he had chains on his arm, and he was like, screw, and it was so intense. And I remember being like, wow, this is crazy. And I remember because he appeared out of nowhere. And it was the first time I'd ever seen theater magic before. Yeah. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. And I just wanted all the kids around me to stop talking. Because I was like, you guys not see this? The guy came out of nowhere, you know?
Yeah, it actually makes you believe in magic, like as though magic is real when you see it work like that, right?
Yes, absolutely. I was like, he wasn't there, and then he disappeared after he was like, you'll be visited by three ghosts, like, you know, that whole section, and then like was gone, and it was like electric, and it was like, it popped. I just remember being immediately captured. Like, that was crazy.
Wow, wow. What was the first theater show you were in?
The first, you know, it's so funny. I just commented on Mindy Kaling's post the other day on IG about this. The first show I ever was in my preschool daycare, a production of Caps for Sale. And I commented because she had just put this funny post up that was like, not to brag. It's her reading like all these children's books. And she's like, not to brag, but I just completed like my 10th. I completed my goal of reading 10 books this lockdown during quarantine or whatever. And one of the books on the stack was, you know, she had like Curious George, all these books, whatever. And one of the books was Caps for Sale. And I wrote on our comments, I was like, not to brag, but Caps for Sale was my theatrical debut.
I don't know Caps for Sale. Will you give us just a quick rundown?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like 4 or 5 years old. All I remember is it was a book about a man who sold hats, and he had like a stack on his head, like 50 caps all stacked on top of one another. And like, he's selling them about town, I want to say. And they keep disappearing because it's like monkeys are like taking the caps. And then like at the end of the book, it's like, ha 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 ha, all these monkeys are in the tree wearing hats. You know what I mean? And it's like, we were like in the tree, like a bunch of kids are like playing hats, like a bunch of kids are playing monkeys, a bunch of kids, or no. Yeah. And then there's like the one person who's the Caps for Sale salesman. That is I've not read that book since that age. I have no idea if those were just the parts that I liked, but that was essentially the book. And hats and caps and monkeys. That's it.
So at first I thought you said Cats for Sale. And so because I'm a musical theater nerd, I went to, it's a parody of the Cats musical, but they're all getting sold.
No. Caps, like hats. No, caps. Yeah. All caps.
No, I got it now, sadly, but I still wish it was.
Could you imagine? So.
You know, it's
a young Jellicoe character
who got brought down to the dock. For the selling. It's like like a mixture of Les Mis and Cats.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A Fontaine.
I love it. See,
when she's cutting her hair, it's her fur. That's what
exactly. It's my goal that this show inspires theater making, actually. Like, I want, like, as we get into dream roles and things like that, I want, you know, 5 years from now for that to then happen and someone harken back to that episode of my first show. So my dream is that Andrew Lloyd Webber hears us, or Cameron McIntosh, and is like, you know what? We need to mix up Les Mis and Cat.
I mean, just to say, I feel like we may have already written it. I feel like all we really need to go out and figure out is how to workshop it.
Right. Right. Over Zoom.
Yeah, exactly. I think we need a 29-hour reading of the production, and we're kind of sick.
We certainly have act one. Amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
Workshopping too. We'll go up to Vassar next year.
So what was your first professional theater show then? And this can be anything. Like, this can be you were on a crew or an usher or, you know, summer stock, but you got paid. Or it could be Broadway, but, you know, anything.
But I got paid for it.
Yes, professional.
Professional. The first job I ever got paid for was this... school theater play called Roots of Rap, poetry. Mm-hmm. And it was connecting. We would go to these school functions, and basically, it was actually kind of cool, and kids loved it. It was like, we'd go and would like sing or do some raps that kids were familiar with, and then loop it all, connect it all back to like all of these poems and poets who were phenomenal, Langston Hughes, Nikki Giovanni. I wear the mask, you know, ego tripping, all these pieces of poetry, beat poetry, so that kids can understand that understand, I guess, the etymology of like hip hop, rap, and what its purpose began as and where it extended from, its roots extended to.
Where was this? First,
I did it here in New York. It was here in New York. Wow, gosh, the name of the theater company is escaping me right now. But we would go to schools. It would be like, you know, they would come and gather at various auditoriums and spaces, and various schools would come in and we would do these pieces and the kids would love it. And I think I remember what the thing was that felt like they loved most. It's like we were connecting to something that was theirs, right? And not talking at them about it. It was just, it wasn't, you know, hip hop that necessarily our parents listened to. It was like, what do y'all listen to? And what we want to give you that connection back to, all this stuff that came out of the 1920s, 30s.
So were you a working actor in New York when you got this first gig?
No, I had done other shows before. I had done an Equity showcase. I mean, I guess this would be the first time I ever got paid, but not weekly. I just got a stipend, you know. I wasn't Equity myself, but I got a stipend for a musical that I did down at the Greenwich Street Theater called Love According to Luke just before that. And when I was doing that, along with another show I had done before it, I had, because I wasn't really making any money, this show I did a showcase for, I made $75. So obviously you can't live on that. And so I was still waiting tables. And when I got Roots of Rap Poetry, colon poetry, that was the first job that I was making, making money, a weekly salary, but not a lot of money, but it was enough money that I didn't have to wait tables anymore. And I never looked back after that.
That's amazing.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And so how many years had you been in New York when you got that first job?
When I got that first job, I had been in New York probably maybe a year or two. I'd been in New York probably, let's say two years at that point.
That wasn't the Epic Theater Ensemble by chance, was it?
That sounds kind of familiar. That actually does sound familiar. I think that might actually have been its name.
Because I went to a rap-based student performance at a middle school in Midtown once, and this all feels very familiar.
You're like, I'm very deja vuing right now.
Well, that's kind of amazing. So, I mean, you were then on a path to be like, I can keep doing this, I can make money, or were you deflated that it was not, you know, in a theater with with the lights on, like at, you know, at 8 o'clock on a Saturday, or, you know, what, how did that experience keep you going and sort of push you forward?
Oh, I felt so excited. Sure. When I got that job, I was very proud of it. I was very excited about it. I felt so proud that I was like, wow, they're going to pay me. I think it was like $239 a week before taxes to do this, you know, to do this job. I thought that was phenomenal. And it was, you know, I mean, and it kept my lights on. Yeah. It kept me fed. It kept me on the subway. You know what I mean? It was, it meant a lot to me. I was very proud of that job. And I got to do what I came to New York to do, which is be an artist. Yeah. I was even more thrilled and excited that I was able to speak to young people. Particularly, I remember a lot of the schools who were coming in were more disadvantaged schools, inner city schools, mm-hmm. who didn't have a lot of resources and exposure to the arts. And so I was especially glad that kids who maybe weren't able to have the experience of going to see whatever Broadway show this city offers, just because they simply didn't have the money, were getting to have some experience and exposure to the arts. And you know, and kind of like what I was just talking about, you know, the show that I got to see as a kid, you know, it was my first time and it blew my mind. The idea that who knows out there whose mind is being blown by seeing us up here.
Yeah. I loved it. And did that lead to Corn Boy and to Godspell? Like, did each sort of experience beget the next in a way?
Kind of, yeah. Like, I went from that, and then I went into my first Equity show, which led to, which was in Pennsylvania, then, which led to me full circle moment getting my next job, which was at North Shore Music mm-hmm. Theater, okay. where I first saw Scrooge. Mm-hmm. I got a job with the same theater company and was stoked for that reason, which then led to working at my first off-Broadway job with New York Theater Workshop. And then so on and so forth after that.
Amazing. Amazing. I had the pleasure of speaking to a former director of yours, Danny Goldstein, from your production of Godspell. And, besides saying how brilliant and decent and humble and smart you are, he also told me about the Godspell Project Runway episode that you did together.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Can you explain, please?
Yes. Okay. So I was a huge fan of Project Runway to begin with. And let's start, like, full disclosure. And they were doing an episode, Project Runway All-Stars, I believe it was. I was doing an episode where they were getting to design, like, it was like maybe the challenge was like theatrical, something like this. Mm. And then getting to design something for a production of Godspell, and which was the show we were doing, Danny and I, on Broadway at the time. And yeah, I got to be a guest judge. Go ahead, YouTube, have a field day. I got to be a guest judge on the show, which was so cool and exciting at the time. I couldn't believe it because I was excited because I loved the show and watched the show,
right?
You know, and I was, it was also like, I don't think at that point they had ever even married Broadway and Project. I think that was the first, if they've ever had any after, the first Broadway challenge that they had ever had. Yeah. And I was just so excited. I was over the moon. I've since seen, like, I have a picture from that, being in the hair and makeup chair and the makeup artist, you know, putting makeup on me. And we were in the dressing room for Godspell. It was just so great. So cool. and the costume they made was great too, and it was in the show.
Oh wow, that's cool. And you met Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn, I'm guessing.
I mean, it was a win all around.
It is. It is. Oh, that's so funny. And at that moment, I mean, that's still early in your career, right? That you're having this sort of like out of body, very surprising television moment. Did you think a lot about the medium of television and how that was a direct path for you and something you were itching to do and destined to do?
I hadn't thought of it in that capacity. I had thought of it before that time, and then very quickly pushed it out of my mind. I hadn't thought of it because as something that was necessarily for me, because I didn't see many examples of it in there for me. I didn't see examples of myself in film and television. And so I didn't think there was going to be space for me. So I kind of dampened those feelings down, stamped them down in myself. And then my manager who came to see Godspell and saw me in the show and who I started working with, she was who really inspired me to pull those feelings back up, because she and I were talking and she asked me if I'd ever thought about doing film and television before. And she was from LA. So I thought, oh, this woman's from Hollywood. You know, she knows what she's talking about. I guess she would know better than anybody. She said to me, have I ever given a thought to doing film and television? And I said, no. And she said, I think you should think about it. I think you might have a real life in that. Wow. And that was the first time I really let those feelings in for real, for real. And going back to your first question, it reminded me to just hold on to the truth of my own possibility, you know, just to not let the definition, you know, the definitions that people have for you versus the definitions and ideas you have for yourself, to really hold on to those things and not stamp them down, not cheapen them because of another person's view.
That's interesting, because you are one of the few people, I think one of two in history, to win an Emmy in two different categories, but for the same role in the same show, the comedy and drama categories. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about your role of Crazy Eyes Suzanne in Orange is the New Black, and I was thinking about how historic that is, but also how adept you are as an actor at both comedy and drama, which are opposing genres in theory, but actually are much more connected than we all realize. And I'm just curious, what do you enjoy more, comedy or drama?
Neither, to be honest. I don't enjoy either one more than the other. And I mean that seriously, because as soon as I start doing a bunch of comedies, I'm like, I want to do drama. As soon as I do a bunch of dramas, I'm like, I want to do comedy. And they both satisfy two different sides of who I am, I guess, that I want to do them both as often as possible. I know that sounds probably like a little dodgy of the question, but I genuinely enjoy doing both for totally different reasons.
Which are?
I enjoy comedy for its release, the absurdity. Like, I like sitting and trying to think of, okay, how is this supposed to be funny? And what is the craziest way I could make it funny? You know, yeah. This is how it's supposed to read. And let's find another way. That how far can I push this and it still be funny? I also like, I'll also say this, because it makes me actually think of the first TV job. Right the week before I started on Orange, I had shot a small part on the show called Blue Bloods, and I had a line in this, in my sides for the audition that was actually supposed to be said very seriously, but I also like playing with language that's supposed to be serious and making it funny. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And so that's what I like about comedy. This line is supposed to be really serious, but actually, is it possible we can just make it funny?
Yeah. Yep.
You know what I mean?
I do. I really do.
You know? I like doing that. And then, and it makes me even think of when I went, I saw the production of Hamlet, the most recent production of Hamlet at the Public with Keegan-Michael Key. Mm-hmm. He was the Horatio. And I remember, like, that's what I think is so beautiful. Like, he had a line, I can remember what the line is. It's right after this, it's like right in the beginning of Act One, Scene One. I think even on his exit. And it's normally, traditionally done dramatically. And I remember he made it funny. And I was like, that's brilliant. He was brilliant in it too. And I was like, this is what makes this genius right here, because you can play with it. And then for the drama side, I love the feeling of trying to shoot an arrow through a needle. Mm. Just that accuracy. And I guess that also lives in comedy too, because comedy I often think of as math.
Right. Timing.
It's timing. But there's something about, like, the way you have to throw your hand to really hit that target and make the point really land and vibrate through your bones. That's what feels, and it's when it's cooking, when it's simmering is what feels the nicest about drama.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, the best films and television shows in history have equal parts both and use them as superpowers in their storytelling. When it's best for humor to be revealed, there's a crazy, you know, punchline. And when it's best for the dramatic emotional arc to be revealed, it's silence and power. And, you know, I think Orange is the New Black just really did that so well all those seasons. Which is why I think that show was so groundbreaking and your performance was so brilliant. So, comedy and drama. It's why there's two masks sitting on my childhood bedroom wall.
Yeah, it's so powerful. And I have to say also, like, it's hard for me to pick the two because both of them feel like flying. And that's what I love, you know? I can't, they both feel like flying, like just a freedom, different ways of expressing it. But I love that feeling. I went skydiving a couple of years ago, which I was terrified to do because I had horrible fear of heights.
Me too.
And thought I was going to I was like, I'm going to die. Tell my mother I love her. You know what I mean? Like, all of it. And I jumped out of that plane and it's the closest thing I have ever felt to making art. Wow. That freedom, outside of also wanting to jump out of the plane and be like, it's me! I feel like I'm having my, like, Elphaba moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's utter loss of control. I've never jumped out of a plane, but I imagine that's the most loss of control, you know, magical moment.
Yes, it was everything.
Okay, dream time. If you could be in any show, anywhere, at any time, what would it be?
One, it hasn't happened. But two, if I was held to the ground, like, ants are going to be poured on my body. Have to pick. I would want to be in whatever production Rex Harrison is in of My Fair Lady.
Oh, the first, I guess.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Love that show.
Yeah. Oh, with that sexy British accent.
Yes. The originator of the, like, patter song. Yeah.
Never could sing. The guy couldn't.
No, I don't. Not a note. But somehow we fell in love with the voice anyway. Yeah. Well, and then isn't that, I always thought, like, I mean, I was just having this conversation some weeks ago as well, my family loves that movie. And iconic, and you love his voice, and just like, what is singing? Is begs the question, because I love what he's doing.
Yeah.
So it's like, right. And I couldn't not hear it done that way, you know? So is that not expression through song?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So great. Loved it.
A lot of men have gotten away with the talk sing as sufficient.
Yes. As sufficient. Exactly. Absolutely.
It's sort of infuriating.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Well, it's like landing in the zone. Like, well, I mean, and it's emblematic. Let's just be clear. So it's like landing somewhere in the zone of what the tune is supposed to sound like. And we'll take it from here.
Well, I'm excited about your Eliza Doolittle. So let's do this. too bad Rex is gone, but there's other Rexes out there.
What other show would I, you know, work on at any time, place another? I mean, like, I'll be the usher at the original Dreamgirls. You know what I mean? Like, I will be seating people just to see that show go off every night. See Jennifer Holliday, Charlie Ralph, you know, Obababatunde, the list goes on. Loretta Devine, you know, original choreography, all of it. I would see all of that.
Yeah, magical, for sure. What a moment, too. That's perfect. That's perfect. Well, we aim to make dreams come true. So,
do you have a time?
I don't have a time. my next comment was, so I think we'll go to sleep tonight, you know. and we'll dream the reality of that happening for you.
I thought you were going to be like, if you look out your window, we have a DeLorean.
It's the final section of the show that we do not tell our guests about, so you don't know what I'm about to say and ask, unless you're a big fan and you listen every week, and then maybe you know. And this is a lightning round where I put 30 seconds on the clock and I list off classic American plays and musicals, and you give me the emotional theme that you think is in that musical, and we see how matched up we are. And it's like one word, two words, three words. So, you know, nothing lengthy, just what comes to mind that you think that musical is about.
Got it.
Okay. 30 seconds are on the clock and we're going to go. My Fair Lady.
Transformation.
Cinderella.
Happily Ever After.
Evita.
Power of Women.
Funny Girl.
Power of Women.
Godspell.
Joy Personified.
Ragtime.
American Dream.
Gypsy.
Ooh. Ambition is good.
Yes. And I agree with that. I agree with that final sentiment. Ambition is good. Ambition is good. God, I love that musical so much. It's actually my favorite, I think, of all time. I could sing the entire score. And I'm not sure I've ever thought specifically those three words as a theme. Ambition is good. But
look what it produced.
Hell yeah.
What she was able to produce. And had she been a man, would we have questioned it? You know, and you know, you just, even obviously we know everything's coming up roses, you know, but she starts the song saying, I had a dream. That's all it was.
Yeah.
She went after her dream.
Yeah. And I think,
what's so wrong with that?
Agreed. And I think a reminder of ambition is good, even in these times. because we're going to come out of it and we need to stay ambitious and focused. And that's how we'll find out what's good.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Love that show.
Love that show. Oh. One of the reasons I miss Marie's Crisis the most is singing that score around that piano in the village.
It's a timeless show. Sometimes there's just some shows that just can live forever. That's a show will live forever.
I agree.
The book is excellent. Score is excellent. There's just so much to be done in it.
Yeah.
Ugh, such a great show.
I agree. Well, I had a dream, and in it, Uzo Aduba was the usher of Dream Girls, not telling Eliza Doo the Little. So thank you for joining us today, and thank you for doing all you do on the screen, and hopefully you'll come back to the stage soon and do it again there.
Yes, please.
You are a genius, and I honor your art. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I had a dream. A dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell. You'll be great.
My First Show is produced by Josh Altman, MEP, Dori Berenstein, and Alan Seals, and is part of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was edited by Derek Gunther. Special thanks to Leslie Papa and Whitney Holden Gore at Vivacity Media Group. For more info about the podcast, visit bpn.fm/myfirstshow. Follow me on Instagram at Eva R. Price. Now's your
star I talk about.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.